So welcome back to our conference, Post-Truth, Web and Democracy. We had a very inspiring morning session, very in the difference, and for this afternoon we will have a more différence session with very, very various tradition that will be confronting themselves. I would like, if you may, to switch to French, because with Michel, when Michel, no, I know that you will be great in English, but with Michel we decided to call this institution Collège d'études mondiales, not Institute of Global Studies, because I think in the concept of monde, hein, le monde est pluriel par définition, il y a le monde grec, il y a le monde romain, le monde byzantin, c'est important aussi, ce n'est pas justement juste d'amener des études anglophones à Paris, c'est pas ça notre mission. Et en plus, je sais que les trois intervenants de cet après-midi sont complètement fluent in French.
Oh, vrai.
Yes, it's true. C'est juste que Paul Bogossian a un surmoi démesuré, donc il n'accepte pas de prononcer son intervention en français. Mais donc, voilà, nous, je me permettrai de modérer la session en français pour cette pluralité aussi de monde qu'on essaie de laisser émerger. Et Michel Viviorca, qui travaille... non seulement il est président de notre fondation, mais il travaille beaucoup aussi sur les questions de violence et sortir de la violence, qui ont des liens évidents aussi avec la question de la post-vérité. Comment justement aussi raconter rétrospectivement ces vérités dures à entendre. Voilà, et là pour introduire la séance de cet après-midi.
Bonjour à tous, merci beaucoup Sarah. Je vais être même pas plus que bref. Je dois partir dans 5 minutes, j'ai un rendez-vous médical que je n'ai pas pu déplacer à 15h. Donc je voudrais juste vous saluer et vous dire quelques mots sur le fond, parce que je trouve que ces thèmes sont de la plus haute importance. Je voudrais faire quelques remarques. Donc, premièrement, ce n'est pas nouveau le mensonge en politique, évidemment. Ce qui est peut-être nouveau quand on parle de post-truth, c'est que c'est une relation forte, transparente entre le haut et le bas. C'est-à-dire que vous avez des gens qui mentent et des gens qui attendent la parole mensongère, et que c'est la relation qui se joue entre les deux niveaux qui explique qu'on puisse parler, comme on l'a vu, d'époque ou d'ère de la post-vérité. Ça, c'est ma première remarque. Ma deuxième remarque, c'est que c'est un phénomène différent mais qui se complète beaucoup, qui se chevauche beaucoup, de ce qu'on appelle en France le complotisme, qui n'est peut-être pas exactement la même chose que le conspirationnisme, mais qui n'en est pas très éloigné. Et ici, je voudrais juste faire un ou deux commentaires. Le complotisme n'a pas besoin d'une relation entre le haut et le bas. Il peut tourner en bas seulement, si je peux dire. Il peut fonctionner uniquement sur Internet, sur les réseaux, par des recherches personnelles. Il y a bien sûr, très souvent, des gens qui le structurent idéologiquement, intellectuellement, des gens qui organisent la pensée complotiste. Mais c'est un phénomène différent et qui a beaucoup à voir, je pense, avec la paranoïa. Pour moi, le complotisme, c'est une variante collective de la paranoïa. Donc ça, c'était le deuxième point. Troisième point, mais je pense que là encore, je dis pour vous des banalités, tout ceci se développe dans un contexte de crise, et en particulier de crise des élites, et de crise des élites politiques, mais pas seulement, des élites politiques, journalistiques, et même des enseignants, des intellectuels, et une crise qui donne l'image que ces gens-là sont dans le mensonge, mais une crise qui n'est pas sans fondement. Ils sont souvent dans le mensonge. Et donc, la post-vérité et le complotisme se développent dans des univers où, effectivement, les élites sont décevantes. On pourra donner tellement d'exemples. Enfin, on a eu un premier ministre il n'y a pas si longtemps, qui avait dit une chose, signé un engagement électoral, signé. Et puis qui, le lendemain, a dit « je déchire ce que j'ai signé ». Bon. Et donc, tout ça crée l'image d'un monde qui n'est pas fiable. Et quand on a cette image, bon. Ma quatrième remarque, c'est que l'antisémitisme n'est jamais loin dans tout ça. Pas tout le temps, pas partout. Au contraire, là, on vient de voir le président Trump à Jérusalem. Donc, bien sûr. Mais en tout cas, dans le complotisme, ça n'est jamais loin. Et je ferai un lien avec ce que Sarah nous a fait écouter la semaine dernière avec Kathleen Blee, qui expliquait quelque chose de formidable. Elle nous disait, dans les groupes d'extrême droite américains, conspirationnistes, white suprematistes, les gens rentrent dans ces groupes, ils sont racistes ordinaires, ils n'aiment pas les Noirs. Et puis à l'intérieur, on leur dit, mais attendez, ça c'est trop facile. Si vous voulez comprendre ce qui se passe, il faut bien que vous imaginiez qu'il y a une explication, et que l'explication, les gens ordinaires ne l'ont pas. Et que l'explication, eh bien, elle vient du fait qu'il y a des gens qui complotent et qui sont invisibles. Et donc là, on rentre dans ce thème très important, qui est que la preuve du mal, c'est qu'il n'est pas visible. La preuve du diable, c'est qu'il a toutes les apparences de ne pas être le diable. Et donc, plus on explique la post-vérité, on peut le dire aussi, plus on explique le complot, et plus ceux qui sont déjà du côté de la post-vérité ou du côté du complot sont persuadés d'avoir en face de lui, d'eux-mêmes, des gens encore plus malins, encore plus diaboliques que si il n'y avait pas ces explications. Alors je dis tout ça pour terminer sur une remarque, qui est un tout petit peu longue, mais je vais essayer de la condenser. Cette remarque, c'est que pour agir face à tout ça, on peut adapter plusieurs attitudes qui ne sont pas nécessairement contradictoires. La première attitude, ça consiste à être un petit peu prudent ou indifférent face à des aspects qui sont peut-être trop gonflés. Je vous en donne un exemple. On a parlé de faits alternatifs, alternative facts. Mais il ne faut pas non plus en faire trop. Alternative facts, c'est juste une expression qui a été utilisée une ou deux fois dans l'entourage de Trump. Ça devient ensuite une énorme affaire médiatique, mais n'exagérons pas. Donc, peut-être une certaine indifférence vaut mieux qu'une sorte de panique morale ou d'emballement médiatique. Deuxièmement, je pense que le discours de la raison est nécessaire mais insuffisant. Oui, il faut critiquer, dénoncer, expliquer, former les jeunes esprits, etc. Mais comme je vous l'ai dit, plus vous démontrez que quelque chose ne tient pas la route, et plus c'est la preuve que vous êtes vraiment diabolique. Donc la raison a ses limites. Et donc la troisième attitude possible, c'est peut-être celle qui consiste à essayer d'être très pragmatique. Et je vous en donne un ou deux exemples, puis après je vous salue amicalement parce que je dois filer, malheureusement pour moi. Premier exemple, je les prends en France mes exemples, ou pas seulement. Enfin, vous avez en France des gens qui organisent des voyages scolaires pour Auschwitz. Alors Auschwitz, ça a été nié, il y a eu du négationnisme dès la fin des années 70, même avant, mais enfin, ça s'est redéveloppé beaucoup à ce moment-là. Eh bien, quand vous emmenez des enfants des écoles à Auschwitz, que vous leur avez bien expliqué les choses, que les enseignants ont été bien préparés et qu'ils ont même bien préparé leurs élèves, que sur place, il y a des équipes qui sont bien formées à organiser, eh bien, ça vaut mieux que 1000 discours pour dire que ceux qui n'aiment pas les Juifs, c'est pas bien. Parce que là, on touche du doigt d'un seul coup. On mélange l'émotion et la raison et l'expérience pratique, et ça a un impact considérable. Et le deuxième exemple qui me vient en tête, il est parisien. Nous avons dans la partie nord de Paris un endroit que certains d'entre vous connaissez certainement qui s'appelle la Cité des sciences et des techniques. C'est très intéressant. D'abord, c'est dans un quartier populaire. Donc les gens qui viennent ne vont pas dans les quartiers des élites. Ensuite, c'est un endroit où les jeunes se voient répondre à leurs questions par des vrais scientifiques, font des expériences, sont confrontés à la raison de manière très concrète. Et ça a un impact considérable. Ça donne confiance dans la science. Et donc, moi, je pense qu'il faut beaucoup réfléchir à ce genre de choses. Comment proposer, face à ces enjeux, des réponses pragmatiques, pas au sens trop philosophique, mais des réponses concrètes dans l'éducation, dans la démonstration. Et on pourrait en trouver de nombreux exemples. Ça n'est pas si facile, parce que parfois, on fait fausse route. Je donne un exemple de fausse route. Si vous allez à New York, à l'entrée du port, je pense que beaucoup d'entre vous connaissez, l'île de Ellis Island. C'est formidable. C'est l'endroit où les paquebots vidaient leurs passagers pauvres, les riches entraient directement aux États-Unis, pour des contrôles en tout genre, avant de entrer sur le sol américain, pleinement. Eh bien, ça a été transformé en musée, et c'est un musée qui est très fréquenté et avec beaucoup de joie. Les gens qui vont visiter ce musée, ben, ils regardent les listes de gens, ils retrouvent le nom du grand-père, des amis. Enfin, c'est très, très bien. Et donc, voilà une expérience réussie, je dirais, contre peut-être certaines idées fausses. Mais d'un autre côté, vous avez à Paris, la cité, elle a changé de nom récemment, la cité de l'histoire de l'immigration. Je ne sais pas si quiconque ici a été visité déjà, cette cité. Bon, mais enfin, la plupart des gens y vont soit parce qu'ils ont emmené leurs enfants visiter un aquarium qui est au sous-sol et qu'on leur a dit qu'il y avait peut-être autre chose à voir au-dessus et que bon, comme ils sont déjà dans le quartier. Quelques-uns parce que c'est une architecture très particulière et très exceptionnelle. Et en fait, le public majoritaire, c'est les enfants des écoles qui n'ont pas le choix. Les enseignants, bon, les gens n'aiment pas aller dans cet endroit. Enfin, c'est pas un endroit qui est... Et donc, c'est pas facile de faire tout ça. Donc, voilà ce que je voulais vous dire. Donc, moi, je pense que ce que vous faites, c'est capital. J'aurai les actes, je pense, de tous vos travaux. Je disais même à Sarah l'autre jour, puisqu'on est dans la même revue, il y aura certainement deux ou trois de vos papiers qu'on pourrait essayer de reprendre dans cette revue. Donc, voilà, faut que je file. Je vous souhaite une belle après-midi. Bon, je pars de pointe des pieds, si vous connaissez.
Merci beaucoup, Michel. Donc, on a le temps un peu compté, donc on va vraiment se tenir aux 30 minutes de parole et 15 minutes de débat. Le premier intervenant, donc on a interverti l'ordre, hein, parce qu'on aura une vidéo à la fin. Et donc, ça sera donc le professeur Paul Bogossian, qui enseigne à l'Université de New York. C'est un spécialiste d'épistémologie, philosophie de l'esprit, philosophie du langage. Son texte le plus connu, je dis le titre en anglais, Fear of Knowledge Against Relativism and Constructivism, qui est traduit aussi en français, La peur du savoir sur le relativisme et le constructivisme de la connaissance. Donc, il va nous parler de Truth and Authority.
Merci beaucoup, Sarah. Je m'excuse, je pense que ça sera mieux si je continue en anglais. I will start with how many people know that Richard Rorty predicted the election of Trump 20 years ago? Yes. Well, since John Searle has mysteriously disappeared. And by the way, can we turn this off? Started out by some hypotheses. I just want to read you this because it's a remarkable passage from a book that was published in 1998, so about 18 years before this election. And this is what Rorty said. It's a book called Achieving Our Country. It's a book in political philosophy. It's about what it takes for a country to come together as one. And he says, members of labor unions and unorganized, unskilled workers will sooner or later realize that their government is not even trying to prevent wages from sinking or to prevent jobs from being exported. Around the same time, they will realize that suburban white-collar workers, themselves desperately afraid of being downsized, are not going to let themselves be taxed to provide social benefits for anyone else. At that point, something will crack. The non-suburban electorate will decide that the system has failed and start looking around for a strong man to vote for, someone willing to assure them that once he is elected, the smug bureaucrats, tricky lawyers, overpaid bond salesmen, and postmodernist professors will no longer be calling the shots. One thing that is very likely to happen is that the gains made in the past 40 years by black and brown Americans and by homosexuals will be wiped out. Jocular contempt for women will come back into fashion. All the resentment which badly educated Americans feel about having their manners dictated to them by college graduates will find an outlet. And it is an absolute, I mean, it is, you know, to have it predicted down to the last detail like this by somebody writing 20 years ago is a remarkable act of insight. And I think, you know, really puts its finger on what it was that elected Trump in the first place. And it's not about people believing that Hillary Clinton is poisoning the water. It is about a class of people who felt that no one was speaking for them and who felt lied to for 40 years and who desperately look for someone who is not part of the establishment who provides hope. Of course, that will turn out to be a total lie as well, but that's an expression of the kind of despair, I think, that is really the explanation for this election and not stuff about there being lots of people out there with crazy views. Now, Rorty was, I think, so incredibly insightful about politics, but really bad on truth. And in particular, he had all the kinds of views about truth that I think are wrong. The crucial point about truth is the one that Aristotle stated a very, very long time ago. There's really nothing more, I won't go into this, but nothing more you need to know about truth than what Aristotle said, which is to say of what is that it is, and of what is not that it is not, is to speak the truth. End of story, okay? That statement is much more important for what it doesn't say than for what it does say. What it says is, of course, completely correct. To say of what is that it is and of what is not that it is not, that is what it is to speak the truth. Now, what it doesn't say is the truth is what we think is true. It doesn't say the truth is what we discover to be true. The truth is what we can verify to be true. It doesn't say any of those things. But what he's very clear and careful about saying is that the truth is determined by how things are, not by people's opinions about how things are. We have opinions about how things are because we seek to find out the truth. We seek to find out how things are. But to confuse how things are with how we accept them to be is to collapse representation with reality. Okay. Now, this is a very, very common, I think, problem. And nothing could be more confusing than just to collapse, I mean, if you like to use the 19th century language, subject and object, or to collapse representation and what is being represented. And this can take a variety of different forms, but the classic one is one that came up in our discussion. I don't really mean to accuse you of it at all, but but it is very, very common. And as I say, you can see this in the language of journalism, even in the United States, to confuse fact with what is widely accepted to be fact, maybe even with what is unquestionably accepted to be fact. Because people think, wait a minute, so when we talk about facts, we're just talking about that thing, right, which no one will dispute because they take it to be a fact. And so why can't we just conflate fact, the way reality is, with what is widely accepted to be a fact? After all, right, when is that difference going to show? Well, I'll tell you when it's going to show. It's when something we always accepted to be a fact, we change our mind about. So it can't be the case that the facts are equivalent to what is accepted to be true, because in that case you'd have to say, you know, the earth went from being flat to being round. Well, the earth did not change its shape. What is true is that many, many centuries ago, everybody thought earth was flat. And they were perfectly reasonable, by the way, to believe that. The evidence available to people, and we're talking millennia ago, was that the surface on which they live is flat. So this was widely accepted. It was unquestioned. It was presupposed in everything that was said. In fact, you know, Aristotle gives a definition of motion in which, well, Aristotle was not confused about the curvature, but in any event, you know, the earth was supposed to be, by definition, unmoving, and things only moved in relation to the earth. So these are examples of things that are presupposed, taken for granted, assumed, unquestionable, it would be considered a contradiction to question them, and so on and so forth. But they turned out to be false. So that gives you a very, very good indication that there is such a thing as the way reality is, and then there is the way it is widely accepted to be. Now, so one of the things, of course, that follows from saying truth is a function of how things are, is that there is no such thing as true for me, but not true for you. Okay? Reality is the same for all of us. Now, you may not think it's the same for all of us, but that doesn't mean it's not the same for all of us. I mean, in one of the great books, Thomas Kuhn, when he was describing the importance of this kind of notion of a paradigm shift in science. Paradigms, again, these great unquestioned background things. And he said, you know, to make it dramatic, he said, you know, scientists who live, who have different paradigms, live in different worlds. But, you know, that's a very sexy thing to say. It's nice, a sexy thing. Oh, yes, the assumptions, they're so all-encompassing. They so condition your perception that we may as well say, we live in different worlds. It's sexy, but it's not good. It's not right. If I understand what you mean, that's fine. I can let you say it like that. But if the two scientists with different paradigms can nevertheless have lunch in the same room, then they live in the same world, okay? And what we need to do is describe it as a difference in their representations of the world, not of the world itself. You can see, by the way, how if you do conflate fact with accepted to be fact, you get a very easy relativism that comes out of that, because, of course, it could be the case easily that different communities accept different facts, you see, and so if fact is acceptance, then we can say some things are true for us but not true for them. The most that can mean is we believe it and they don't. That's the most it can mean. Now, what does it mean, therefore, given all of this, and given the simplicity of the notion of truth, to say that we live in a post-truth world? What do people mean when they say that? I'm not. By the way, I think there is something they mean when they say that. And secondly, I think that what they're saying is true. Now, when I say that what they're saying is true, as I say, what I don't mean that we live in a post-truth world in the same way in which it is really true that we live in a post-dinosaur world. Okay, that is to say, there used to be dinosaurs, now there are no dinosaurs. I'm not saying that, A, people claim this, well, maybe they claim it, but certainly not true, that there used to be truth and now there is no truth anymore, there's something else. No, what they mean is just what the Oxford Dictionary said, which I was glad to say I hadn't seen that definition. What it means is that we live in a world in which somehow or other considerations about the truth of propositions are playing a less important, less influential role, let's say in politics and maybe in civil discourse generally, okay, than they used to play. Now this is, interestingly enough, this is a sociological claim. It's not a philosophical claim. And it's a question of the extent to which issues about truth and the rational discovery of truth are or are not playing an influential role in contemporary civic belief. Now, Chiara, I think, was absolutely right to say, and also, what's his name? Michel. That this is hardly, the fact that there have been lies, as it were, social lies, or lies on a big scale, or there are sometimes people have been coerced into accepting things that they are not true, and maybe that they even know not to be true, and that this has played an important role, is not a new phenomenon. So the question is, when we say we are somehow living in a post-truth world, what is new about the phenomenon? I think there are several things that are new about the phenomenon. One of them is that there is much more acceptance of the idea of relativism, even in factual domains, that is, not even about ethics or normative domains, but in factual domains, than there was 50 years ago. So there is much less of a grip that people have, much less confidence that they have in the idea of the truth, a single thing. Secondly, I will come back to this. Secondly, I think it's also true as a matter of empirical fact that the disdain and the disrespect shown considerations involving truth by people in positions of great power and authority in democracies is also at an unprecedented level. I think the kind of contempt that people in the Trump entourage have shown for very, very basic considerations that show that something that they said was false or ridiculous is unprecedented, certainly in democracies. I mean, in authoritarian governments, it's of course not unprecedented. And one of the things that makes this particular administration authoritarian is precisely its relation to considerations about truth and rationality. So when I say my title is Truth and Authoritarianism, one of the points I wanted to make is, of course, authoritarian governments have, as a matter of, practically as a matter of definition, a need to downplay the importance of truth and of the discovery of truth. Why is that? It's quite simple. If you're an authoritarian government, it means that what you want to simply implement without a lot of consideration for public or rational discourse, the agenda that you have. That's what authoritarianism is. The last thing you want is for somebody to put up their hand and say, but by the way, this thing you're assuming is not true. Okay, so if what you want is to win the votes of the coal workers in coal mining country, and it serves your purpose to say that there is no climate change going on as a result of CO2 emissions, it's very handy to be able to say either there is no truth of the matter about this, or who are you to say? I have my own experts. Okay. So authoritarianism has a tremendous interest in downplaying the importance of considerations about truth. And the third way in which, so there's alternative facts, there is who's to say I've got my own experts line. And the third is to use a technique of sowing so much confusion and creating so much noise in the public discourse that nobody knows quite what to believe. Okay. And you can keep it coming so rapidly that everybody is off balance. You know, one of the things the journalists were, for a while, they were very happy. They suddenly had a mission in life. CNN, which was like dead, they suddenly had a mission, which was to expose all the falsehoods that were coming out of the Trump administration in the first 2 weeks. But everybody is getting fatigue. You know, you're getting lie detecting fatigue. And that's a very real phenomenon. People stop caring. They're 5 times a day, you can no longer keep up with it. And that itself is a very, very effective means of getting your way, because people simply become tired of fact-checking you all the time. Now, the first of these, of course, is the most powerful weapon. So the third one has a lot to do not just with the kind of noise that's created by an administration, but with the tremendous amplifying capacity of the web. I mean, the web just makes it possible to sow massive confusion, to have various things that look like news sites that aren't news sites, to have various things, you know, you can dress up a website very quickly to look like it really knows what it's up to. And so the web is an essential tool that's being used in this erosion of our confidence in the capacity to bring truth to bear on what we do. But I think it's extremely important that we don't say that the technology is intrinsically evil. Technology, I think, cannot be intrinsically anything, certainly not normative. It's how it's used. And this is an extremely important part of any discussion that we have, not just about technology, but also about concepts. And that's something I will come back to in a second as well. So it's very common to say that somehow, I think Maurizio came close to saying that the web is somehow intrinsically to blame. I think a technology can't be intrinsically to blame. It's a question of how it's used, and therefore it's a question of the will with which people use it. The same thing goes for the concept of truth or the objective truth. Now, I think one of the things that we all have to admit is that before the notion of an alternative truth or alternative facts or post-facts became so popular with the right, and by the way, I think Michel was wrong that it was just a couple of times that somebody said alternative facts. I think this has become quite common language. Before it was promoted by the right, it was, of course, massively promoted by the left. Relativism and anti-objectivism about truth was a great darling of the mainstream left. And it was taught like this by, in fact, since the mainstream left are the main people who were faculty in humanities and social science departments, it has been taught to undergraduates for at least the last 30 or 40 years. I don't think you get somebody like Kellyanne Conway coming out of nowhere saying on national TV about something like the size of a crowd, well, I have my own alternative facts. This comes from many years of being taught by philosophy professors, maybe some of them in this very room, that there is reason to be suspicious of the truth. There is no such thing as the facts. You know, there are perspectives. There are facts from the perspective. Now, why did it appeal to the left to be so suspicious of the truth? Now, obviously, you know, people thought they had philosophically sound arguments for this, and maybe, you know, I don't think there are. I think there's nothing but incoherence that lies at the end of trying to deny the idea that there is such a thing as the truth. But there was also a moral thing behind it, you see, because, ironically, although I just finished saying that authoritarianism has a problem with the truth, there is a sense in which the truth has an authoritarian aspect itself. And this is part of the motivation. In other words, when you believe that there is such a thing as the truth, you have to believe that somebody who disagrees with you is making a mistake. That's what it is. If you believe that snow is white, okay, and somebody you come across, okay, maybe that's not the best example because it's not really relevant, believes of the same snow that it's not white, then even if you think, look, they're perfectly rational because the evidence to them where the colored light misled them into believing that it's actually red when it's in fact white, they are making a mistake. They are wrong about the world. So it follows from the very nature of saying something, okay, that if you think one thing, the person who thinks the opposite is simply wrong. And many people thought, well, that's a very objectionable authoritarianism. Okay. I remember having this discussion with the great Italian philosopher Gianni Vattimo, who was very, he said, you analytic philosophers, you are in love with this notion of the objective truth, and you've come across as such authoritarians for that reason. So I said to him, look, okay, tell me, is the door open or shut? And being a smart guy, he could see the trap, and so he said, I refuse to answer. But you see, this is a ridiculous situation when you've got a major philosophical figure and you just ask them a simple question, then they say suddenly there's a trap. Of course, if he says it's open, then he's excluding its being shut. And that's just in the nature of assertion or belief. Searle was saying something like this earlier. So, what to do about this authoritarian aspect of commitment to the truth? Well, there's nothing to be done about that. That's just part of the thing. But what one has to realize is that commitment to there being the truth or facts of the matter about the world is consistent with fallibilism, the view that you might be wrong. Okay? It's consistent with humility. You were bringing this out, of course. Humility, meaning you think you're onto the right track, but you are aware that there are other people who are nearly as smart as you and have arrived at different conclusions. Okay. With therefore lack of certainty in your own convictions. But most important of all, even if you didn't have any of those things, even if you believed that you were right and that you were certain, and that there was really no reason to think that you will be shown to be wrong, nothing follows about whether you are permitted to impose your view on somebody else. This is the thing, this is where the left, as it were, took the baby and threw it out with the bathwater. Okay? This is the expression we use. If you're worried about using the notion of absolute truth or objective truth in an oppressive way, for instance, in colonial contexts, don't worry about that, because you can hang on to the notion of the truth without any fear that you are therefore required to impose your view on somebody else, because whether or not you're allowed to impose your view on somebody else is a moral question that is left completely open by a commitment to there being something called the truth. So the famous, you know, people have these famous slogans. How am I doing on time? Famous slogans that say absolutism is opposed to, is supposed to be authoritarian, and relativism is supposed to be tolerant. But both of these famous maxims are false. I mean, there is a trivial sense in which absolutism is authoritarian, and that just goes with simply being saying something. And as we have seen, relativism, which can appeal to alternative facts, can be used in the defense of highly intolerant and highly immoral views. So relativism is not intrinsically tolerant, and absolutism is not intrinsically authoritarian, except in the mildest of possible senses. I mean, the real difficulty has to do with what are you going to do about the dissemination of rationally arrived at knowledge of the truth in a context in which it's so easy to confuse people about what is reliable and what isn't, about what is trustworthy and what isn't. And of course, that's a very, very big question. But once you have put aside the idea that the technology itself is to blame, I think you can see that the only real hope is education, okay? Because as long as you have, which we don't have in the United States, and that explains part of what Rorty was talking about at the very beginning, right? Because he talks about the fact that the workers who were motivated in this way, part of the problem was that they were not given sufficient education. If you have an educated citizenry that is skilled in the art of critical thinking so that they're able to evaluate for themselves, you will not have the dangers of this kind of wild dissemination of falsehood. I'll stop there. Yes.
I have just a point about technology and then consideration. It was too much obscure about technology, because my point was not that technology in itself is the evil. I was saying that technology in itself is the condition of possibility of post-truth. We cannot imagine post-truth situation without the web, basically.
I think you could do it with TV.
Yes, but for TV it's different.
And because, also newspapers.
I would say that there is something specific, because as a TV viewer, radio hearer, newspaper reader, you are just a reader, passive. Whereas in the web, you are also a broadcaster. This is the relevant difference.
Right.
But this is just the point.
But I mean, in terms of weakening the hold, weakening the influence of truth-based considerations, the fact that you're a broadcaster, I think, is neither here nor there. What really matters is how mass opinion is controlled in a way that's not responsive to truth. I think that you can do with any mass medium.
Still, I'm not convinced of this, because the real difference, for instance, media like radio or TV produce great mass movement. And I would not say that, for instance, radio produced Hitler. Even we know that Hitler massively used radio during his campaign. He was democratically elected, and the radio was really helpful for this. But this is not the point. This atomization and horizontalization of the public opinion is typically of the web. For me, at least, I want to insist on this topic. But what I would say is that what we should do at the very end, I was say, we need a practical reason for the web, and the need of practical. We will not say that we leave the web and we come back to what. What exactly? Not to the TV, not to the radio, or there is not such a kind of alternative. I believe that, in fact, the practical reason for the web I was requiring is, in a sense, very close to achieving our country, in a sense. Rorty was not, was in a sense, web-free. But the need he was claiming for an education is the need I have for a practical reason. So just to say, you know, I agree with you that technology is neither good, neither bad, neither the two.
Good.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, I agree with every single sentence you said. but nevertheless, I wanted to hint to one lacuna, to one thing that is left out in your picture, and that seems to me to be quite important: the ethical aspect of truth. So, if you are a Humean, and may disagree, but mainstream analytic practical philosophy is Humean still, then you say we have a good reason to do something only if belief desire tells us to do it. So we optimize desire fulfillment given our beliefs in doing it. This is widely accepted as a criterion of rational practice. Now, if uttering a judgment is a kind of acting, and you subsume it under this criterion, then you utter a judgment in case it's preference fulfillment, optimizing preference fulfillment, given your beliefs. In some cases, this judgment might be the right judgment, the judgment that you yourself believe in, and in other cases, not. And this is has a long tradition, from Plato beginning, to say, well, in politics, you just utter this what is useful for your strategy, and so on and so forth, independently from the question whether it's true or false. So there is the ethos of epistemic rationality involved. And probably some leftists and many rightists don't have this ethos included in their value system, so to say. Marxists, for example, of the traditional style, they never doubted that there is scientific truth. But the question whether you utter it depends on cui bono, what class interest is held in saying it or not saying it. So what you say is instrumentalized.
Yeah. So look, and I think, first of all, I am not a Humean in the sense that I believe, I didn't have time to go into this, that there are normative facts and therefore normative facts about which desires one ought to have. It's not all just open territory. But you see, here it's very important to make a distinction between belief and utterance. You see, assertion is a speech act, it's a public act. Okay, and instrumentalizing assertion is not a completely wrong thing. In fact, I think it's the correct view. You have to take into account who you're speaking to, what the context is, and what the outcome will be of your saying something. That doesn't apply to belief. You should believe what is true, okay, and therefore you should believe what there is evidence to be true. But whether you choose to say it is very much a function of all kinds of circumstances that you're going to find yourself in. And that's why I said that's the important thing about the reason why the authoritarianism that's implicit in the notion of objective truth does not translate into colonial oppression. Because, you know, that's the fallacious move. The fallacious move is, well, if there is such a thing as the truth and I know it, and these poor people don't know it, then wouldn't I be doing them a favor by shoving it down their throat? No, nothing follows about whether you're entitled to do that. So, but that's part of the instrumentalization of what you're allowed to do. But I think that's a terrific point, yeah.
Chiara. Yes. Just a question for clarification. If you get it right, somehow you dismiss sociology, which I'm not a fan.
I can't hear you.
If I didn't get him wrong, somehow he dismissed sociology, which I'm not a fan, defending the pure philosophical notion of truth.
Hmm.
Even though I have the impression that then you used a lot of cultural ideas of sociology about to define what is authoritarianism, but let's get to the part. How do you link democracy and reality with a pure notion of truth?
Pure notion of truth. Democracy and reality is a notion.
Yes.
I don't know what a pure notion of truth is.
The truth.
Let me explain. This is, again, this is part of... Truth is about how things are. They are. You know, my favorite example is the shape of the Earth. Okay, that thing, the Earth has been spherical for a long time. Okay, but there were long, long periods in human history when everybody was absolutely convinced that it was flat. And it took a brilliant genius like Aristotle to realize that the things he was observing in the sky and the shadows cast and so forth could only be explained if the surface were spheres. It was a very indirect inference, okay? It took great genius to figure this out. So, the pure notion of truth. Here's the pure notion of truth. The fact of the shape of the Earth. The sociological thing is what we believe. Now, we believe one thing for a long time. Eventually, we shifted, and it's not just an arbitrary shift. We didn't just go, well, they used to believe that then, now we believe something else. We believe now that we're closer to the truth, and every bit of evidence that we get from the sky and from above seems to confirm it. You see? That's belief, that's rational belief, that's evidence for belief. But the fact itself, it always remained the same.
But my question.
Oh yeah. So, but the role of that with democracy. Well, the role of any truth. Take climate change. Okay. What role does that have in democracy? I'll tell you. Our cities will sink if the fact is that the ice sheet is melting and the seas are going to rise in 20 years. Then lots of people are going to die, and lots of what we value is going to disappear. What role does that have in democracy? I'll tell you what role it has. It's crucial.
How can you use these to play it into democracy?
You can't use...
I know that you are going to see.
You see, what you're after is a magic pill that is such that if we could only put it in the water, like fluoridate the water, then everybody will start acting rational. That's not going to happen. That's not the point. Here we're making philosophical distinctions about all the things we need to recognize. Okay. One of them is that there is a fact of the matter. The other is that people can sometimes believe something that's not true. Thirdly, that there are better and worse methods for believing what is true. And finally, that there are ways of manipulating people that are irrational or irrational ways of manipulating them into believing things that promote certain agendas and not others. Now, what if you want is, give me a method by which I can be sure that these terrible politicians don't do things like that. I don't have that method. But it is not solved by saying facts and widely accepted to be facts are the same thing.
May I have a sort of a remark maybe similar to, in a way, to Chiara. I'm coming from a very different tradition, philosophical tradition that is more, you know, linked to phenomenology, psychoanalysis. So very, very different tradition. But I agree with some of your thesis. But I'm wondering, what about social facts? It's not just a history of door. Yes, okay, door could be open or closed. This is quite simple fact. But for instance, what's your view on a social fact as Christmas? Yes. Christmas is a fact or is not a fact? And even people who don't believe in Christmas, for them, is a fact, a social fact. So it's quite, I don't know, because you is a sort of a chemical process that you are doing, but the reality is much more.
Well, let's talk about Christmas. This is a good one.
Christmas. So Christmas is a sort of, is a naive question, but we are in a candid country, so be aware of it.
Look, if I say religions exist, that is just a purely factual remark about the world. It's of a kind, John Searle did a great job of saying, look, there are ontologically subjective things, that is, these are humanly constructed things, which are real. Just because they're humanly constructed doesn't mean they're not real. And you can make epistemologically objective remarks about them. I'm glad this thing is still up because it's relevant. Now, there are religions. That is an objectively true remark. Okay, it's a human construction, but truth about it. According to one of these religions, a savior was born. Okay. Is that a true remark? Well, according to the religion it is, but whether the actual proposition is true, I will say no. Okay, let's suppose that's true. Now, is it true that it is celebrated, this birth, this alleged birth, is celebrated at a certain given moment in time? Yes. Is it celebrated using all kinds of pagan objects like the tree and so on that came from completely different traditions? Yes. No problem about this. Now, to talk like this, to talk about the truth, doesn't mean I have to say stupid things about Christmas. Okay. You can say all the things you want to say about Christmas. It just gives you a clearer way of thinking your way about the difference between Christmas and, as it were, electrons. So there is no problem.
No, okay, there is no problem, but I think that
it's
so simple to establish what is the fact. It's
establishing,
not always a question of shut the door, open the door.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the that one wasn't about croyance.
Yeah, yeah, croyance is very important. Look, that question point about the door wasn't about establishing whether it's open or shut. It was to show, again, something that John Searle was emphasizing this morning, that it's in the very nature of belief that if you believe P, you have to think that somebody who believes not P is making a mistake. And so to that extent, there's a certain kind of authoritarianism just built into the nature of belief. It requires you to think of the disagreement as somehow not fault-free. Okay. It can be fault-free in the following sense, in the sense that both sides can be perfectly rational in having those views. They can't both be correct, because the world is one way and not another. But if you ask, look, the people who believed that the earth was flat, were they perfectly rational? The answer is absolutely. They were very perfectly, going by the evidence that they had, they were brilliant. It was just wrong. It was incorrect. Now, then the question is, well, how do we tell? Suppose there is a disagreement in a community between two people, one of whom believes P, the other of whom believes not P. How do we tell? And the answer there is, you know, we have, and we all agree on what the methods are. Okay. Now, the real fly in the ointment is normative disagreements, because there are no good established procedures. But on all factual things, there are established ways of resolving the disagreement. And when there isn't, as sometimes happens even in science, the answer is, you should suspend judgment until we discover what the right answer is. But I think what's worrying you, you see, is that well, I don't know what's worrying you, actually. I mean, I think you're, in the case of normative moral matters, you know, if you like, whether to wear a veil or female circumcision, where there are strongly held views on both sides, you're absolutely right. I did not say anything about normative matters, and that was the lacuna that that Julian brought up. But I have lots to say about that, but I wasn't about to say it here. The interesting thing is that even if you are as anti-objectivist as you want about normative matters, this does not translate into a kind of alternative facts about the size of a crowd at an event, or the number of people in this room, or about all the huge range of factual things that there is no disputing.
Do you think that that most problems, like, because you talked about this, that it's in the nature of belief to think that, you know, one is right and another is wrong. And then you gave the example of the door. And would you say that the most interesting problems are of that nature? I mean, you know, the usual, it's not all black and white, then you go into wicked problems, for example. I don't know if you're with wicked problems. I'm not sure aware of the wicked problems terminology in STS, science and technology studies. I mean, well, it's permeated. Like, for example, the environment is a wicked problem, you know, the climate change. It's got certain characteristics. And key to that is this distinction between, you know, in the original paper, they say, you know, there's simple problems at hand, and there's also wicked problems. And they class scientific problems, whereas policy problems are wicked. But the other question is, what you said that, you know, the truth is, your view of the truth is separate from the moral question of imposing your view.
Of what?
That your view of the truth is different from the moral question of imposing, well, then you have the right to impose your view on somebody else. What did you say about evidence-based policy then? Wouldn't that challenge evidence-based policy, where there, somebody is trying to impose policy based on evidence, truth maybe,
yeah. down.
Do you see what I mean? Wouldn't that be a problem?
For instance, having CO2 emission curbs or something like this?
No, there's wide measures. It's very circumscribed what evidence-based policy is. Like, you know, Nancy Cartwright talks a lot about this. You know, there's many, like, you know, we should base our evidence policy on scientific evidence, let's say, from the social sciences as well.
Yes. Look, when the question what policy you should have about something as enormous as climate change and CO2 emissions and all of these things, an enormously complex thing that takes into account a huge number of variables. Of course, every factual input into that deliberation should be as rational and as evidence-based as you can make it. Okay? You want all the inputs, the factual inputs about what, how much CO2 emission there is and what it's doing to the environment and how quickly the ice sheet is melting and all these things. These are factual things, and you want to have as accurate a view of those as you can. Now, many of these things, maybe that's partly what's meant by wicked, many of these propositions can be vague. Okay, this may be something that's bothering you as well. You see, I mean, even open and shut is vague. I mean, how shut does it have to be? Does it have to be locked? Does it have to be pulled all the way shut? Is it mostly that there's no light coming through? You can ask, all propositions in language and thought are vague so that they have borderline cases. This is not interesting because we have to deal with that anyway. But when you come to the question of how to input all of that into a policy, you have to take into account an enormous range of considerations about the growth of the economy, the impact of people, the number of deaths that are likely to be caused one way as opposed to another, and so on and so forth. And I don't have any simple formula for that at all.
Listen about this passage in which you say that commitment to truth does not involve imposing our view on the others. I wonder if this is really true. It seems that in some cases we are committed. Since some lie can be dangerous as such, right. For instance, somebody say vaccine causes autism. It seems that in this case we are committed to impose our view on others.
What I said is that the commitment to impose would not come from the nature of truth itself. It comes from a moral consideration in which the truth plays a role, just as it plays a role in any other consideration. Okay? In other words, sometimes believing a falsehood can be so bad for either the person involved or for the rest of us that we have a duty to stop it. That doesn't come from the mere fact that what you think is false. It comes from the fact that what you think is false plus all the terrible consequences. Okay. So sometimes there is a commitment. Now, all I said is that the question of the commitment, the question of action, is a moral question that comes downstream from settling what the truth is.
Okay, so it's an anti-Kantian position. So Kant has this view in which truth is moral to be always sincere, to always say moral values.
That's the Kant's crazy view about morality. It's not about crazy view about truth. The crazy view about morality, which he thought somehow it was always required to tell the truth, even if the consequences would be terrible, and nobody buys that. Not me. Okay, there you go. One person buys it. I said something false.